So that was kind
Interesting.
of.
So you started with the marketplace, and then you realize what you really need to get them on is the SaaS, like get them into the internet on a multi-tenant kind of SaaS CRM for real estate developers, so they can keep track
Exactly.
of their investors and their vendors and all that stuff.
Exactly, Brian. Yep.
Wow.
And so they had to, and again, we were also faced with, they were like, we're Reg D 506C. What are you talking about? I can't, my lawyers have said I can't advertise, that I have deals. So we were up against that, those lots of barriers. So I was like, great. We give you the software. You'll do it, your private offering to your own high net worth investors. And they would come back and say, my investors love it because they can go online. My investor relations person loves it because he or she has this admin console and they can manage everything. And I love it because, like, I'm not having to dial for dollars. I can send them to this beautiful portal that they can go through the process.
Welcome back to the Ignite podcast. Today, we're delighted to have Tor Steen on the show. Tor, welcome. Longtime fan, co-investor with you on many deals on CrowdStreet. Big fan of that platform. Thanks for coming on the show.
Certainly, Brian. Great to join, and thanks for having me.
Well, we'd love to get an intro from you for the audience, for those that don't know you.
I guess the best way to sum it up is I guess I've been in tech for a long time. I hate to date myself, but I jumped into the internet space in '98, so that was 1.0, I guess, and I loved it so much, and the power of what the internet could do for consumers and businesses. I never got out, so my career's been kind of fraught with disruption and transformation, both B2C and B2B, and I've enjoyed the path and the journey, and some of the things that we've accomplished along the way.
And that was after you got your MBA from Duke, if I recall from your bio.
Correct. Yeah, I graduated in '96 from Duke with my
Wow.
MBA, and it was an interesting time because I think in my graduating class, most people, right, are going investment banking, management consulting, and I did the management consulting thing for 3 years post business school, and it was great. I mean, there's a lot that I learned and a lot I
Like a
took
postdoc
forward.
MBA, that's how
Yeah,
I
it's kind of
describe it, yeah.
exact, but then there were like a couple of people in our class who went to these dot com companies, right? And this was '96, so it was
Wow,
like,
yeah.
I remember taking an internet marketing class my second semester, and it was like literally learning how to code in HTML because the only thing that had come out was like Netscape. And so a couple of grads actually went to dot-com players in the Bay Area. I went the traditional route, but then I quickly jumped out of that into the internet space.
What amazing timing. I graduated undergrad in 2003. It should have been 2002. I did the 5-year plan because I switched to finance after a year of history. I realized how boring reading letters were between people in the 1700s. So I switched to business finance. If I would have graduated in 2002, that would have been perfect timing. I don't think the market had quite fallen out, but by 2003, it was a crazy recession.
No, it took a while for it to fully impact, that's for sure.
Well, walk us through kind of the, that early, decade or so of your career between, joining an internet company, what that internet company was, and kind of walk us through to, CrowdStreet.
Yeah, it's interesting. In '98, when I jumped out into the internet space, actually, I went to a brick and mortar company. It's the old term is what we used to use, AAA, which everybody should know what AAA is, right? 100-year-old company. But I joined them to actually in their corporate development, corporate strategy group to help figure out what is this internet thing all about? How is it going to disrupt an 100-year-old business that has 40 million members across the United States? So it was kind of a fun assignment. It was like, I didn't jump to a typical dot-com. I went to the brick and mortar and tried to be the change agent. That was kind of fun, but like any big, 100-year-old company, they're usually a little slower to move. So I got frustrated. I said, okay, well, enough of that, enough of trying to roll the brick up the hill. Let me go to an internet company. So I joined a company called Earthlink, if you remember them.
Yep.
They were kind of the early player in the ISPs. But the part of the business I joined was their consumer products group. So it was the kind of the My Earthlink or the equivalent of a My Yahoo start page back before people just went to Google to start their web experience. They would create their home pages, right? Their portals.
Yeah, I remember
So
this.
Earthlink.
Yeah.
Earthlink would have a portal, and so I was running all biz dev, so all the ad sales and all the online partnerships. And I was fortunate at the time because this was like, again, right after the crash in 01. So, it was like we actually had to create revenue models that worked, not just slotting fees. And so I got to work with the likes of Amazon and eBay Expedia, Disney, you know, a lot of content, commerce, and community providers to make up our portal. So it really afforded me the opportunity and my team opportunity to help kind of remake what the business models of rev shares and CPMs and CPCs and CPAs, what it would look like post the crash of 2001, you know, the dot-com crash. And so it was kind of a fun time to, you know, in essence, kind of rethink and rebuild that consumer experience and ultimately one of the business models that you can make money, not just have eyeballs, right? Because that was the big thing was, oh, it's just a bunch of eyeballs with no real revenue models behind it. So that was kind of my phase one, which is like, hey, let's get into the Earthlink. And then I went to a B2B company, WebTrends. And that took me from Atlanta, where Earthlink was headquartered. So I'd gone Bay Area back to Atlanta and then back up to Portland, where WebTrends was. And WebTrends was a web analytics software company. And we've been consumers of it by my biz dev team, right? Because we were trying to figure out the web traffic and how you position things. And so seen it from a consumer perspective, saw the value of what it could bring to businesses that are, you know, like Earthlink, we're trying to determine, you know, how do we create better experiences for the end user.
What are some so you guys were basically reinventing business models and new ones that didn't exist prior, right?
Yeah.
What were some of those aha moments?
Oh God, I'll tell you one, probably one of the most exciting ones I was actually doing this partnership with a company called Google back in 2001.
I've heard of, they used to be the internet leader, right?
Yeah, exactly.
OpenAI came along. No, I'm joking.
And I remember actually being in a meeting. This was like 01 to 02. And Sergey was, you know, it was still pretty young. And so we were talking to their product group about the fact that they were going to release this AdWords product because they'd been non-pay. Mm. It was all, hey, we're creating the search engine. And so much like with and traffic. So they were really interested in the fact that we could be kind of like their early adopter of this new paid advertising in search results versus the organic. And we had been working with an 800-pound gorilla in that space, Overture, who was all about paid ads, but really didn't do much on organic. And so took the leap and we became the very first partner of Google with their AdWords product in the market and brought them a huge amount of traffic, which helped, you know, kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy because we were getting them so much traffic. Their ad sales team was able to go out there and sell more ads on their new AdWords product. So that was kind of one of the, you know.
Was it like basically a rev share deal? Like, hey, we'll send you traffic, but we want a cut of the, you know, the
exactly
CPM that we generate for you, basically.
Exactly. And so I was able to, I like to say now I would never negotiate the deal, but I was able to negotiate a real sweetheart deal at Earthlink because, you know, they wanted the traffic. They needed the traffic for their new AdWords product. So that was a really fun partnership and kind of new model in terms of how are we going to make this rev share work for both parties.
Wow. That's been really cool that you were there right at the ground floor of that. Probably the best business ever invented, right? Just prints money.
yeah, exactly.
And then, what happened next?
So I joined WebTrends after Earthlink, and then that was more of a turnaround situation. So they had been bought by NetIQ, which was a big, you know, IT services company, and it was a typical acquisition gone wrong. So 3 years afterwards, they kind of set up WebTrends as a little business unit. I came in to run corporate development. Helped take them private. So we went and got private equity funding, tried to run it as its own kind of single, you know, company. And at the same time, Omniture was the other, you know, Omniture and Website Store and a bunch of other web analytics players out there trying to become the big players. So unfortunately, only one of them went public, and that was Omniture. We were number two or number three player at the time. And I think it was a good lesson learned because nothing against the private equity guys, but their expertise is many times how do we take a company, carve it out, put some leverage on it, and try and milk it for EBITDA. And we really need more VC funding to say, hey, how do we carve it out? But how do we really grow this business if we want to IPO it, if we want it, to grow? And so kind of, you know, probably the wrong type of money. Yeah. Where the business needed to go.
Interesting. So they went the PE route rather than the VC route. What was that kind of decision process?
I think, you know, they were owned by the parent company, and no fault. The parent company's like, hey, we just want to get some money for this thing as we spin it out. And, you know, probably not as vested interest in who the suitor is or what's going to happen post.
Yeah, the highest bidder kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So,
but really, you should have spun it out, raised a round of venture. So, hey, we're going after this huge market opportunity. We are the number two player. Here's the plan to be number one.
Exactly.
We're going to go raise, you know, $50, $100 to do that.
Exactly. So that was kind of a lesson learned. You know, it's kind of, again, I love the assignments. It's hugely intellectually challenging to spin a company out, to set it up, and to, you know, to help run it. I was running all corporate business developments, all strategic partnerships for WebTrends. But kind of after that, you know, did that for 3 years. And then, you know, when that finished, it was really an aha moment for me, Brian. It's like kind of looking back on my career and saying, okay, so I did banking before business school. I did consulting, and then I jumped into the tech, and I've had different experiences in tech, you know, B2C and B2B. You know, and what do I really get passionate about? You know, kind of the reengineering and restructuring was, you know, it was intellectually challenging, but it wasn't as fulfilling. And so when I reflected, I was like, I really love the kind of, you know, blank slate of, you know, starting new business development area, or even at Earthlink when we were kind of creating these new types of partnerships that nobody had created before. And so I said, well, it's time to jump into to doing startups at that point and, you know, kind of make my own problems, if you will, but really, you know, start from the ground floor.
And so that's CrowdStreet. That's the CrowdStreet story.
Or something before that. Before, yeah, I had, okay. had a stop before, which was, I think, really good, like before jumping into CrowdStreet. Gentleman by the name of Larry Jubas, and Larry's great guy. And this is while I was still in Portland. And Larry was actually the, kind of like he was even pre maybe he was the guy who built Rocket Mail, which was the first web mail product.
Yeah.
Got bought by Yahoo. He did his time at Yahoo, and it was basically Yahoo. And so Larry's a super smart technologist, and he was trying to solve identity on the web, right, which had been broken. And so he had created this protocol called OpenID and a company called Janrain. And this was still in Portland. So I was Larry and a few software engineers. And I got to know him through a VC. As we know, VCs are great connectors. And so I got connected to him. And Larry, he said, Tori, you want to come on and help me? I built this open source stuff. And I think it could be really applied in the space. I had seen it at Earthlink as a publisher of how hard it was to get consumers to come to your site to give up their information and tell you who they are. And, you know, marketers over time had kind of deprecated all the information they were trying to gather to just get an email address. Well, then you don't really know, you know, who your user is. So I thought, hey, this is pretty revolutionary. OpenID and OAuth and these technologies, if we could get Facebook and LinkedIn and at the time MySpace, if we could get these players allowing their users to take their identity across the web. Wow, wouldn't that be powerful? It'd be good for a consumer because they don't have to recreate who they are to every website. They can simply click to log in. And for the websites, they could get a whole bunch more data on the user without making them fill out this stupid registration form. So Janrain was really, we were the pioneers in enabling that to happen. We created a SaaS solution. We you know, went out and worked with a lot of the media and entertainment companies to say, hey, put this on your website, make it easier for your users. And by the way, you're not only going to get a higher user adoption, but you're going to get more rich data about who they are. So that was fun. We did that for, I did that for 5 years.
Wow.
It took another 5 years till they actually exited. They all ultimately exited to Akamai.
Not a bad outcome.
No, it was good. I think it was, you know, a tough space to be in as they started to grow up to more of the enterprise identity and started competing against other players like Okta and players like that. Right. So it became more challenging of a market once you went beyond the social kind of.
Do you think Okta succeeded where not a lot of people have probably heard of Janrain?
I think Okta, you know, from the early days, you know, recognized that they were solving that enterprise identity space, right? And kind of like, hey, you know, and you've got a lot of money from IT professionals being spent in that space.
Yeah.
So it was like, hey, let's go to where there's already big budgets. We were trying to take and kind of carve out like kind of marketers, you know, a budget that was already being like sliced up in a lot of places.
At least the first budget gets slashed as well.
Exactly. Yeah. So
yeah, that's a tough place to be also in the late 2000s in MarTech.
Yeah.
In fact, that's when kind of like a lot of the technologies and platforms kind of turned over. MarTech was like that 2009-10. That's when Marketo kind of ascended, and you know, Rocket Fuel, the company out, the unicorn I was at, kind of was founded around that time. Those guys came out of Yahoo. It's interesting how these recession capital constraining environments actually force innovation a little bit. Business cycle itself.
Well, it's going to be interesting, I think, in the real estate space, see what's going to come out.
That's why I'm anxious to get into the real estate tech, because, you know, you and I both have, you especially, this real estate tech background. Walk us through kind of the inception of CrowdStreet. Where did that idea come from, and what were kind of those first years of that company?
So it wasn't as simple as it almost was. My co-founder, Darren, he comes from commercial real estate. And again, a VC connected us. They're ultimate connectors. And we weren't even, he wasn't raising capital at the time. He was simply like, hey, I'm looking for somebody to be a co-founder to this great idea I have. He came out of the real estate space, and he saw through the Great Recession the impact it had on investors, the impact it had on the real estate companies, right? When you have such a huge impact like that. And so the good news is the Jobs Act, without getting kind of too technical, the Jobs Act was created to say, hey, you know, let's try and decentralize capital formation, because that mantra that the big banks are too big to fail is probably not a winning proposition, right?
Right.
Because we all saw the bloodbath of what happened. And so I think the Jobs Act was really, it was paramount, because it allowed you from a legal perspective to finally do a private offering to a public audience, right? You could now say, hey, we're going to raise capital. Whether it was a company, real estate, whatever the offering was, the security that you're offering, you could now use the internet, because you could now, you could advertise to initially accredited investors, right? And then there's other ways you can advertise to the non-accredited. So Darren had this idea. This was summer of 2013. The Jobs Act had just come out, and it was still kind of, you know, ambiguous of like, what are really the regulations here? But he had that idea of, hey, if I could take this commercial real estate project, and instead of just shopping it, and you know, to high net worth investors at the country club model or to institutions, what if we could take that to a lot of investors? And so we had lunch, and I went home that night and told my wife. I said, I'm on to the next startup, and she said, oh, great, here we go again. But it was really, it didn't, I guess, I did a lot of diligence. I like to say Darren and I spent 2 or 3 months really fleshing things out and meeting a lot before saying, hey, but my initial impressions, as I asked him 100 different questions over lunch about, because I wasn't a real estate expert, I'm a tech guy, but I love learning new industries. And so I just kept peeling it back and peeling, hey, Darren, well, how do they raise capital? Boy, that feels like it's a real analog, archaic way to raise capital. So kind of, wouldn't this help the real estate people? And then being a tech person, I was like, yeah, I don't get invited to the party. I don't know real estate developers. So I never, you know, it hit me personally of, I would love to have real estate in my portfolio. I just wouldn't know where to start, right?
Right.
So I start on the internet usually. It's like, give me something that actually puts it in front of me, makes it easy. And so that's kind of the origin story. And then it was a matter of, you know, like any marketplace, how do we go find supply and demand? And,
right. And
you start small and you grow from there. We can get into that for sure.
Yeah, I would love that. Walk us through kind of that inception. So you guys are meeting, hashing out all the details. At what point did you raise capital? Like, how far along were you guys, you know, for potential founders out there? Kind of what's that story like?
Yeah, so I like to say we did, you know, 2 or 3 things right in the very beginning. So before we went and started really trying to raise that seed round, so we went to go find about $1 million. We ended up raising like $1.2 million of a seed round, and just a convertible note. You know, kind of this is kind of before safes became popular, and so it was just your standard convertible note front end.
Was it like 1 out of 5, or like, what was the valuation in that seed? Was it 1 on?
I think it was only 1 on 4. So,
okay. Yeah. So, it's pretty. We'd call that a pre-seed now. 1 on 750 on 5 or something like that.
Rounds were a little smaller then. And so before we started raising that, which was in 2014, I said, Darren, let's try and get a sponsor, a real estate person to actually, let's get the marketplace built. So we used an outsourced group to build the MVP. We got them to do it on a convertible note. So we went to them. We weren't taking a salary. We weren't taking any salary. So like,
well, what does that look like? That sounds like Tor with his BD experience going in there and saying, "Hey, how about give you a little piece of the company and you build this MVP for us?"
Luckily, they were a group that did some of those projects, right?
But nice.
You better believe in what you're doing, and I can't.
Well, now they're more motivated too, right? Yeah, that ownership.
Exactly.
That's interesting. How much did that MVP cost?
Oh, I think it was like, don't quote me on this, it's probably like 100, 150.
100, 150 on the four.
Yeah.
On the, so you give them, a quarter point of the company, yeah. Something like that.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Okay. Nice.
Anyway, so we got the MVP being built. We went out, Darren did a great job because he knew all the commercial real estate. Found a great, typical who's the innovator that would launch their first deal. And then, we kind of had no marketing dollars. So it was just telling, our networks, using our own guerrilla marketing of spreading the word out, and basically had a landing page of just put your email address in and we'll let you know when the first deal comes up. And it was April of 14.
Wow.
And so we closed the, so get the MVP built, try and get a proof of concept, right? Like, hey, let's get a deal going. We raised $1.5 million on the deal. We were scrappy, as you can imagine, because the MVP was like, hey, we had the front end, kind of the stuff.
What was the deal? User. What was that very first deal that flowed through?
It was in Bloomington, Indiana. It was a short-term rehabilitation, ground-up short-term rehabilitation center. And the pitch was like, hey, most of these centers are 30 years old. They're dated. There's need in the market, baby boomers aging for these short-term rehabilitation centers, right? And so it was a great, beautiful facility that they were building. Great developer, knew the market, regionally based. That's how most of those developers say they know their market. That's where they focus. Raised $1.5 million and it was a successful exit a couple of years ago after it came out of the ground. So good exit for the first investors on the platform. So that really helped us as we went out to raise that round, which we finished that summer.
Yeah. And then tell us about growing that marketplace. So you get the first deal done and now it's like, okay, this is working. We raised $1.5 million. We need to go get more supply, but you also have to go get more investors. Like, how did you balance that and grow both sides of that? Yeah. Marketplace.
Exactly. The fun of the marketplace. I love marketplaces.
Yeah.
So
they're fun.
Myself, right. Cause it's so challenging. Everybody thinks like, oh, you build a marketplace. It just happens. Right.
Yeah.
No, not that easy. I like to say, in any marketplace, you also have to say, where do we have to focus most at this point in time? And that point in time, we really had to focus on the sponsors, the developers, because the way I looked at it, Brian, we should go try and get investors. But if they come to your market, if they come in your store and there's nothing on the shelves, they're going to be pretty disappointed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we needed to focus, the sponsors we had to focus on had to understand we don't have a huge base of investors. So we kind of had to use that supply to help get more demand to come to the platform versus trying, let's go get demand and then tell the sponsors we had to kind of tell them like, hey, we want to set your expectations realistically that you might only raise $1 million. So we were raising $10 or $20 million at that point. We were raising $1 million. And most of the sponsors were perfectly good with that. They were like, look, this is a R&D project for us. This is something that we're testing out as a new way that we could raise capital, understanding it could take us years till we start raising significant capital through the online channel. So luckily we were fortunate to say, how do we stair step up as we start to build that demand? Because we also want to focus on quality sponsors that also had brand name recognition in their markets, because that'll help us. It's like put that name on your platform. It's like, hey, they're going to help automatically grow that demand, because there are going to be people in their market. They work, and they would get some word out for us, Brian.
Because they probably have a bunch of LPs that want to write small checks, and they're like, well, it's too small. Exactly. But you could use this syndicated thing over here on Crowd Street if you want to write a small check.
We actually had some developers that in those early days actually would say, hey, will you help craft the messaging I'll send it to this base of people that I have?
Right.
That, again, we're like, wow, that's great. You're helping fill our funnel of new users on our platform. Yeah. So I think that was, in the early days, that was really important, right? Or more organic leveraging the supply to help drive that demand. And then as we grow it, then we started to obviously have money for marketing. We were testing all the different channels.
Yeah.
SEM, SEO, affiliates, and then, eventually building partnerships with the likes of like Motley Fool. How do you then, from a demand perspective, go find players who already have built that trust relationship to bring their users to your platform?
Yeah, that's really smart. And what were some of the more successful tactics on the investor side?
Yeah, the investor acquisition.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the affiliates was really powerful because, and these are affiliates that you and I wouldn't know. I mean, milliondollardoc.com. I mean, suddenly, they had 50,000 accredited doctors. Like, holy cow, right? Who are already going there for, kind of the fun of the blog and the articles and things like that. So suddenly, these specialty affiliates, they already had a kind of audience that was primed and ready. And they would put us, they would analyze and say, do we want to introduce CrowdStreet to our base, right? And what content can you guys, it was educational. How can you help educate our investors? So I think those specialty ones, I think the Motley Fools and the Stansberry Research, those that I guess are all about online investing and already have created that kind of excitement amongst their user base of like, hey, we go out and we analyze and we bring the stock picks to you. Well, it's not a stock pick. How do we bring real estate to you? We've gone out and analyzed, the platforms and chose CrowdStreet as really the platform to introduce you to. So those were really successful partnerships. In kind of, again, too many companies, and it's been written, get too dependent on Google, Facebook,
right.
All the usual. That's just you're just bidding up. And so from a cost perspective, whereas the affiliates, it's like, per registration. So it's usually a flat fee. Higher conversion users that are more actually interested and truly interested in what they're coming over to do.
So you'd actually pay for registrations to avoid kind of the broker-dealer relationship of money's placed. It's like, hey, I'm going to pay you a certain amount for just emails. People that come over and sign up, give me their email. We know they're accredited.
Yeah.
You ask them in the form. Yeah.
Yes. And it's easy to back into a CAC on that because you just know conversions. Pretty good data on conversion rates, how many become investors over time, might not be, immediately. So you usually know what a reasonable CAC is on, on a registered user versus.
And what were those affiliate, how much did you pay per registration, just roughly?
I think, don't quote me on this. Yeah, it's been a while and I wasn't running all marketing. I mean, it's probably about $100 to $150 per registered user.
Wow. That's pretty high.
Full registered, not just an email address.
That means fully onboarded. What does that mean on CrowdStreet?
That they designated accredited, that they put in their their profile information. So they're pretty serious.
Yeah.
Individual that is coming there for a reason.
Wow. Yeah, that's not nothing. $100 per is something. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I guess if you're out there paying $1 per click on Google, you're probably going to be in the same kind of CAC anyway.
Yeah, dollars light, about the search terms and
so to walk us through some of so that's kind of the inception. Tell us about kind of the middle and late stages, and it's still going, obviously. And walk us through kind of the rest of the story.
Yeah, I think there were a couple. I like to say different stages, as you say. And again, people say, Tor, what stage do you like? I've realized in my career, I love the early stages.
Me too.
The late stages are interesting, but it's trying to, it's like trying to find new land and explore. And one of those early stage things that happened in that, as you and I were talking about those early days of trying to get deals, was we went out and talked to the sponsors, the real estate developers. Many of them looked at us like, you got to be crazy. I would never raise money in this internet thing. And we're like, what do you mean? Like, don't you want to distribute it to as many people as you want? That's why you use the internet.
Yeah.
And they're like, yeah, I can't handle, I've got 50 ultra high net worth investors. I can't even handle that. And I was like, well, what kind of CRM system are you using? Like, how do you manage? And they're like, CRM system? What do you mean? I just send an email out. And I'm like, but how do you manage the workflow? What are you talking about? We just PDF all the docs, and then I have this IR person trying to put it all together on a spreadsheet. And I'm like, holy cow. So what I love, Brian, is that early stage is there was an aha moment of, I'm talking to these real estate developers about the power of a marketplace, but they've never done an online transaction on their own, right? It's like the merchant trying to do e-commerce for the first time. They're like, holy cow, Amazon, hey, let me show you how to do this, right? I know a thing or two. So we actually created a white label software of CrowdStreet's marketplace, and I licensed it to the developer. So that was kind of in that early phase was we actually took a pivot and became a both a marketplace and a software provider. And many of the investors out there were like, you can't be both. And I'm like, I can right now. I agree that, you know, later on it'd be tough. Like the only player that's really done a great job is Amazon, which has AWS and a consumer marketplace.
Right.
But I said, I need to do this to seed the market. And so we would see of the real estate companies that were licensing their software, we'd see a 50% conversion rate within 6 months to come and put a deal on our marketplace. So I had to teach them to fish first before they went to the big pond is the way I like to look at it. So that was
interesting. So you started with the marketplace and then you realize what you really need to get them on is the SaaS, like get them into the internet on a multi-tenant kind of SaaS CRM for real estate developers. So they can keep track of their investors and their vendors and all that stuff.
Exactly, Brian. Yep. Wow. And so they had to, and again, we were also faced with, they were like, we're Reg D 506C. What are you talking about? My lawyers have said I can't advertise, you know, that I have deals. So we were up against that. Those lots of barriers. So I was like, great. We'll give you the software. You'll do it. Your private offering to your own high net worth investors. And they would come back and say, my investors love it because they can go online. My investor relations person loves it because he or she has this admin console and they can manage everything. And I love it because, like, I'm not having to dial for dollars. I can send them to this beautiful portal that they can go through the process. And so then they would see the light and say, oh, if I gave you a part of that deal, you could raise it on your marketplace in addition to me raising it directly for my investors. I said, great. I'm not trying to take your investors. I want you to grow your investor base. So that was an early phase. Now, eventually, you know, we had like 150 clients that used our software at the peak by like 2018, 19. And we hit about 2000. And this is just as like Juniper Square and some of the other investor relations software players were starting to grow up as we were doing this. And so we were actually competing with Juniper Square early on and you know, other players that were doing this. And I'm like, yeah, I don't want to be an enterprise software company. I want to be a marketplace. And so by 17, 18, it became clear. And this is, you know, startups, it's fun. This is the part of the fun. It's like, wow, we're having success selling our software to these developers. A bunch of them are coming to us now that are using other software that are actually technology enabled that aren't using our software that love our marketplace. And we're also focused on getting investors. What kind of company are we now? We've got too many. We've got all these opportunities that we're now seeing kind of good success. And so it's 2017, it was an aha moment of like, hey, we got to go back and figure out who's our customer here. Who's our primary customer? And it's the investor, right? Even though we weren't taking money at that time from investors, we did this because we wanted to help investors. And so ultimately, you know, helping a software, you know, being a software company to help a big, large enterprise real estate developer manage their own investors that had no, that didn't want to come to our marketplace was like really kind of conflicting. So we actually, I built a partnership with Juniper Square and I said, hey, we're going to end the life of our software. And we've got a great partner in, you can move over to Juniper Square to do your own investors. And this integration with them will allow you to still put your deals on CrowdStreet. So I love the evolution. Again, that was kind of another phase, I would say, from 2000. That early phase was 13 to 17. The next phase was like 17 to kind of 20, where it was like, hey, let's focus on that demand side. And it was at that time, Brian, that we then, you know, when you focus on who your customer is and you say, okay, how are we going to help our investors? By 2018, it really became clear of like, hey, the fact that putting single assets up was great. And many of the more advanced real estate investors loved it because they could pick and choose their deals. But there's a big population that says, just make it easier for me. And so we had to create our own RIA and bring to market our own funds. And people would say, wait, are you trying to be an investment management company? Because now you have an RIA. And I said, no, it's a means to an end. I have to create these funds to help onboard these investors. And so, you know, oh, I see. And the data would prove it. People, 35% of the investors that would start in one of our funds would then go invest in single assets. I like it to like, hey, buy a mutual fund and then maybe you have an affinity for tech stocks.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of our next phase. It was like, I'd say like the 17 to 2020 where we really started to see the demand, the investor growth. We started to see some of those channels that we've been advertising, affiliates, and then Motley Fool partnerships like that, that were really coming on to grow that investor and an awareness by investors, right? Many investors didn't even know this was possible. And then we had this thing called the pandemic in 2020, and that, you know, threw a little wrinkle in things, but it was a good test. It was a good test to say, like, you know, what happens? And just as you and I were talking about, you know, recessions and the impact, it actually had a positive impact because it opened up the eyes of many of the larger real estate developers that just raising institutional money, especially when you have to, you can't fly around the country and you can't meet people in person, that they have to figure out a digital strategy to fundraising. And so we had some of the largest players actually start to use our platform in the summer of 2020.
Oh, wow.
So I'd say that was a real turning point. And that next phase where we started to really go up a notch in terms of the types of developers that we're going to use Crowdstreet.
Yeah, and I think that's
they're slow to adopt. We know, right, Brian? Yeah. It takes some of them 10 years to finally say, oh, let's go try this right. new thing out.
Yeah, I mean, if what you're doing isn't broke, why try to fix it, right? From their perspective, yeah. And you get the kind of the hungrier entrepreneur tech-oriented developers to say, yeah, I'm going to give this a shot. And
yeah,
so yeah, walk us through, you know, kind of some, you know, final ahas or kind of retrospective on that CrowdStreet journey.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of them, and this is kind of a final phase. It's like, okay, you've gotten to a certain scale, your size, you know, you're growing rapidly. And again, yeah, probably from lesson learned. So I guess I should build the team. You probably did it a little too late in terms of, you know, bringing on an expertise and the compliance. And, you know, I had never before CrowdStreet been in a, I think my early bleaching time, but I said, I never built a startup in a more regulated environment.
Yeah.
So I think that's one thing. You know, again, I love the tech side. So to me, it's just like, hey, you know, I mean, again, we're going to follow the law. But again, you know, it was early days. We were just building a general marketplace. Then we became the RIA, and then ultimately we created the broker dealer. I think that was kind of one of the ahas, is like, hey, could we have done that earlier? And would that have put more, you know, safeguards in place? And you know, again, it's a huge expense to do those kind of things. I think, Brian, you know, maybe that's something where, hey, who could I have brought in earlier on to complement, you know, my skills that had kind of regulated compliance markets standpoint.
Right.
It's stuff I don't enjoy doing, honestly.
Better to delegate the stuff you don't like to do.
Yeah. And so as I've looked out there, and fintech's a wonderful space, right? I mean, when you think of fintech and you think, or even real estate tech in the investment space, it's just huge opportunities. But there's a reason it's still slow to adopt and change. Yeah. And part of it is you have to say, hey, we're still living within the confines of this regulated financial services right. industry. And the innovators have to figure out how do you still move fast and still kind of have all that compliance and regulatory.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, CrowdStreet was kind of like the angel list of real estate is how I might describe it. Would you agree with that characterization? Yeah.
I think that's a good way to look at it.
Was the business model very similar? You guys would take a percentage of carry. There's a kind of like a fee for, you know, syndicating the deal, and like walk us through kind of that business model and how it maybe evolved from the early days to now that it's fully developed.
Yeah, the early days, it was very much like a SaaS model. So because we had the SaaS offering, it was easy to say to the developers, hey, you're paying this for SaaS. And especially those that use the SaaS that wanted to use the marketplace. To make it easy, I always believe, like, how do you make it as easy as possible? To make it easy, we would say, hey, we're just going to increase the rate of that SaaS because now you're using our platform and not just a private label version. And by the way, because we're doing all this marketing for you, we're doing more technology, and we actually have services. We have IR people to actually help the investors. You're going to pay a higher rate for the SaaS. So right. I mean, it wasn't easy. It was like, hey, we had to figure out models to say to develop. We go, oh, okay, well, usually they're tuned to saying, I'm going to pay a percentage of the capital raise.
Right.
That's a broker-dealer model, which we weren't a broker-dealer. So right. I was like, I can't charge and I can't sell. So, you know, this is how I'll have to do it. That evolved eventually to when we became a broker dealer, it became a lot simpler, right? It was a percentage of the capital raise. And we also, under the SaaS model, you know, what we all love about SaaS is that recurring revenue.
Right.
You know, they might pay a little bit more on the first year license, and then they would pay an annual recurring revenue stream. That's, they were going to use our platform to report to investors. They were going to use our IR team to kind of be that customer support for them. So there was a reason to pay that ongoing recurring revenue. It wasn't as much as year one. When we became broker-dealer, same thing. You're going to pay more for the capital initially, but you're also going to use our platform. So you're kind of like an ongoing administrative fee. So that's kind of how it evolved.
Yeah.
But ultimately, you're staying within the bounds of what's the cost of equity, right? All these play, all these real estate guys, what's the cost of debt? What's the cost of equity? So they have in their models, you might say, this is how we're charging. And they're like, that's great. I need to make sure this pencils from a pro forma perspective of what we're paying for our debt and our equity ultimately. They're like, and they were fine with like the way we did it because they could actually equate it and say, okay, it's within the bounds of what we would normally charge to like a placement agent or a broker to go raise us the capital instead of paying it in a technology fee. And then when we became a broker dealer, it became even easier. It was just like, here's what it is. It's, you know, 3%, whatever the percentage was based on the tier of how much they were going to raise.
Right. A sliding scale based on money's raised, like, you know, up to a million, it's this, 1 to 3, it's this, that kind of thing. And
exactly. Yeah. More, you know, they're used to that model. So it was harder in the beginning because we had to explain our pricing model.
Right.
But yeah, they're smart individuals. They, from a finance perspective, they easy to figure to their some equity.
So walk us through the transition. So you've recently stepped away as CEO. Walk us through why it was the right time to step down and step aside, and what's gonna in your future.
Yeah. So I love, as we talked about the different stages of companies, you know, kind of we got to that third stage, and it's got fourth, fifth stages to go. You know, became a lot of operational execution kind of stuff, and not as much, you know, finding the new frontier, which is fine. I mean, it became, you know, I got to 50 million of revenue. But, you know, to go from 50 to 200 million, you know, kind of takes a different DNA. And it's quite honestly not something I love doing, or nor probably the expert at doing. So we had one of our advisors come in who used to run BlackRock's real estate group. BlackRock's huge.
Oh, wow. Jack's, amazing.
Jack's tuned to do that. He's been an advisor for the company for the last 5 years. So he kind of knew the business and, you know, knew us really well. So it was great. Kind of transition to him and for me to, you know, step into just a board role.
That's awesome. And then you're also taking on some board roles, including a portfolio company of ours, NADA. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So, you know, again, I had to, you know, as I kind of rolled to the board role at CrowdStreet, I said, okay, let's survey. What do I love doing? And I love startups. I just love the, and again, I love the space. I love real estate as a space, as a vertical. I love marketplace models. I love SaaS. And so, you know, as I kind of surveyed that, as I started to talk to VCs, especially now that I'm living in Austin, we moved to Austin about 3 years ago. And
is this one of the COVID moves, or you're kind of like reevaluating where you live now that
you're
kind
of
stuck in the house all day, every day?
Part of that, yeah. And part of, you know, to get to a little sunnier place than Portland.
Yeah.
But also, you know,
Portland people are in denial about how bad their weather is.
It was too, and, you know, not used to it. You get used to it.
You're kind of like, it's cold and wet for like 6, 7, 8 months out of the year, and overcast a lot. And you're like, what am I doing here?
You guys go, well, look at the natural beauty, right? Of course, the rain.
Beautiful out there.
It's one of the most beautiful places in the country. Yeah. Anyways, we looked at where we're going to relocate, because we'd gone to a virtual company. And it was actually an interesting transition. I did it very quickly. I did it in the fall of 2020. I said, okay, we're not going to worry about coming back in the office or which office. And I said, we're going out of an office. Well, we don't know when the office is going to open because we were in the midst of COVID. And I said, to alleviate everybody's concerns, we're going to go to a work from where you work. So if you want to stay in Portland and work here. If you want to move back to be closer to family across the country, because we all dealt with this big catastrophe, feel free. But you're going to work from home. We're not going to have an office in 100 different markets. And so when we did that, we also said, hey, if we had to rewind the clock, where would we want to incorporate and set up CrowdStreet? So Texas, was a place where we naturally said, well, this is a great place to have the company.
Yeah, for a variety of reasons, the tax benefits, the nucleus, concentration of
The
talent
talent.
there, and just
Exactly.
the scene overall, the weather, proximity to the
Yes.
Caribbean. You can fly down to the Caribbean or Cancun in 2 or 3 hours. Like it's a nice place to live.
I've never lived in Texas, so also moved to Austin twice before. And so it was almost destined. I really love the Central Time Zone. Ease of getting to the West Coast, East Coast, and as well as calls throughout the day.
I think the
So
only
it's
thing I
been
would
fun.
miss is being able to drive to snowboarding. Like I'm
That
an
is
hour
a
and a half from
challenge.
Tahoe where I'm at. Like you have to basically get on a plane to ski or snowboard.
I tried the drive, the road trip, Brian. I don't think I'll do it again. So I drove up to Taos, and that was about a 12-hour drive to New Mexico. So I won't do that again.
Yeah, it's too far. I just did the road trip last week with the family for spring break, and it was, me, my wife and 3 kids in a minivan for, 2,000 miles for, 8, 9 days straight, driving, 4, 5, 6 hours a day, every 2 or 3 days. It was a lot.
Yeah, it gets old. I guess back to your question on Nada and
Yeah.
kind of what I'm and so like as I looked out there, I love that early stage company and so I got introduced to John Green, the president, or CEO, co-founder. Obviously, they're doing something similar to CrowdStreet in the residential space,
Yeah.
and it's all about how do you take and unlock the value of that asset, that home equity that people have, and especially in a market where rates have gone up so much in the last year and a half. People have so much equity built into their homes, and Nada says, okay, well, people want to unlock that value without selling it. And so
Right.
Nada is able to say, well, we'll actually extend capital to you as the homeowner, so you can do home improvements. And 70% of their homeowners, that's what they're putting it towards, are actually putting it towards, solar on the house or a remodel or things like that. And then ultimately take shares in those homes, pool them up as a portfolio. And then be able to give investors an opportunity to invest in those funds that then gives them a residential exposure without actually having to own a short-term rental or things like that, right? Whether that's actually the act of it's
It's
passive,
really
it's not a passive
smart. It's
investment.
almost like a simple agreement for future equity agreement, which I thought was very innovative when I first heard the concept. I was like, why hasn't this been done before? This seems so obvious, where you take out a note on your equity and with a promise to pay in the future at some kind of rate, and you have no payments, right? So it's kind of like an interest only, no payment balloon kind of note. It's pretty innovative. And then they kind of approach it kind of like CrowdStreet with these funds at the city level, where, hey, you want to invest in home equity lines of credit for the Bay Area or for Portland or wherever. Here's that fund, and you can get a certain return profile and yeah, really innovative.
John and the team there are doing a great job, right? And I think
Yeah.
to your point, these and what I really love their motto, the supply side, just compare it to CrowdStreet is so much easier, right? Because here on CrowdStreet, we had to convince these real estate developers to want to raise capital this way. Here it's really going out and homeowners saying, oh, wait, there's something other than a HELOC, and it's called an HEI, home equity investment product, right? But that's still in its infancy. And I think it's more and more homeowners say, like, wait a second, I don't have to pay a monthly debt fee. And this is just actually, and I'm, I own, I have this much equity in my house and I can unlock that. Why not? Right.
Right.
When I go to sell it, I'm going to obviously have to pay off,
Yeah, you want to do it
that.
intelligently. You want to use it for home improvements like solar, a pool, an extra room, a remodel, stuff that you're going to get your
Increasing
money.
value.
Yeah, you're increasing the value of your home. I think it could be a smart investment because the rates aren't low, right? I mean, you could get a better rate by going and getting a standard HELOC or something like that, but then you're adding a monthly payment
Exactly.
until you pay that off.
You got full cash going out. So that's been,
Right.
it's been fun. It's been fun. And, again, early stage. So
Yeah, very cool.
back to my roots.
And I'll have John on the podcast eventually, I'm sure. I usually
Oh,
have
yeah.
all my founders on the podcast, so and just really
Well,
interesting people I know like you.
John's way more interesting than me. I mean, he was actually a rock star, if you know. I mean, he was
Yeah.
actually, in a rock band. So I don't have a music inclination at all. So.
That's so cool. Why don't we close out with a quick rapid fire?
That sounds great.
What was your first job ever?
First job ever, well, mowing lawns and being a camp counselor.
That's awesome. Yeah, I was a door-to-door magazine catalog salesperson in sixth grade. That was my first job.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, that'll build some character.
Exactly.
What's one technology you can't live without?
I would say everyday thing I do is Google applications, all the,
Yeah.
Google Docs and stuff like that.
Workspace
Just,
and Gmail and yeah,
everything.
I live in that too.
I converted years ago, and it's like I just when I go and work with company old the bigger companies, they have Microsoft stuff. I'm not bashing Microsoft.
Hey, don't bash Microsoft. No,
But
I'm
yeah,
just joking.
exactly.
You know what's funny is when I worked at Microsoft, I really liked the ecosystem. I do think Outlook is a superior email product, especially now. That wasn't the case 10 or 15 years ago. And Teams is so integrated and makes so much sense for internal teams to work on. But that being said, I run my venture firm on Google Workspace. It's just simpler and cleaner and faster. And anyway, what's your favorite book or books of all time?
I think one of the it's a classic is Get to Great.
I need to reread
Just
that one. I read it in business school like 20 years ago.
exactly.
I should probably
It's a
go
great.
reread that again.
Yeah, it's a classic. I mean,
Yeah.
it's one of those that'll always it'll live on regardless. Like even if you picked it up now, Brian, right?
Are you an early bird or a night owl?
I'm a night owl for sure.
Yeah, me too. Like I woke up at 9 a.m. this morning. My wife was pretty upset. I was like, I was up to 1 o'clock doing stuff.
But this way, my wife brings me some coffee because she's an early say like she'll bring the coffee and get open that the aroma will get me that.
That's smart. I'm going to tell my wife that. You want to wake me up, just bring a nice fresh cup of coffee and put it on the
Exactly.
nightstand. Who is your most impactful mentor in your career?
Yeah, I mean, this might be corny, but it's definitely my father. So yeah.
I love that.
Because I think of a mentor that's been there forever from the
Yeah.
time I was a little kid, all the way to even he's 86 years old. He's doing
Wow.
great. Yeah, and he moved to Austin, so
Oh, great.
30 minutes away. So we still talk business, and I look to him still for advice.
That's so cool. I hope to have that relationship with my kids as well.
And
That'd be amazing.
he just shared with me the other day at a brewery. We went and had beer. We're sitting out there, and again, why I love Austin is the market news here. Huge
Oh,
outdoor is because
yeah.
it's such great weather. He's like, I'll get a tour. I want to run something by you. I got this startup idea, and I said, Dad, you're 86 years old. He said, I can't help myself. I said, Well, now I know where I get it.
Oh, that's great. I love that.
Yep.
Yeah. What do you think, what are some parenting tips if you kind of look at his style? You turned out pretty great. Like if you look back at his parenting style, what was it about the way he raised you that enabled you to do so many great things?
Yeah, I think it was interesting because he, without getting too much, he immigrated. He was Norwegian, hence the name for. So he grew up in a very traditional Norwegian, European style.
Yeah.
But I think he adopted into the American way as he came over in college and stuff like that. And so I think one of his parents, he was like, I always knew my father loved me. I didn't mean, and he also was like, hey, I don't have to be Tor's best friend because he needs to. I need to show him, and sometimes that means. If he did something bad, a little
Some
bit of
tough
a
love.
punishment.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think that was really good. And I think it kind of carried through to business of like, hey, as a leader, you want people to respect you, that you want people to trust you, you want people to follow you. You're not necessarily going to be their best friend every single day, right? Maybe they're going to be a little frustrated and upset, like, oh, wow, but we have to work this much harder. Because something went wrong, and again, mistakes happen. But it's like, yeah, well, unfortunately, this means we're gonna have to rewrite this. We have to redo this. And so, I think that was, it came through from him.
Oh, that's great. Well, this was an amazing conversation. Thank you so much for coming on. Really enjoyed it, and I'm sure the audience will too.
Well, spending the time together, and thank you.
Thanks so much.